Morning, everybody.
Morning.
How are you? Oh, let's see something in front of you again. Northwestern or something. Inquisitor, that's me. Inquisitor. All right, so today we're just going to launch into it. I have a little clock here on my iPod that says it's about iPhone. It's, whoops, about 9:40. When are we meant to be done by? Oh,
about 10:30.
10:30?
Yeah,
great, 45 minutes. So this is going to be quite a romp. If you'd like a copy of this in some way, I'm happy to loan it to you, but please don't publish it or use for any other purposes than for your own private use. One day it's going to come out as a book, and it'd be nice to be able to control the way that actually comes out rather than kind of coming out odd ways. So, you have been singing Lord of History. I hope you realise how significant that statement is. Because the fundamental claim of this time together is the only reality we have access to is history. It's the only reality we have. And the implications of that are enormous. The postmodernists are absolutely correct. You and I, as human beings, do not have independent access to any kind of absolute truth. We simply do not. And the reason we talk like that is because we come out of a long history in the Western world, and most of us don't know the origins of that history. We're going to go through it today. But this is why Christians are fundamentally on about history. This is why the Bible is on about history. It's why the New Testament is on about history. It's why when you read the Gospels, they look so different from Plato or Aristotle. As a fundamental statement about the nature of human understanding and how we get to know anything. So the Lord of history, absolutely, that's all we have, our experience. Okay? So John's Gospel is about this. Remember, it's written to the Greco-Roman world. And John is telling a story about a God who is unlike any other that the ancient world has seen before. That's going to become clearer tonight when we talk about holiness. Really clear tomorrow morning. Are we going to have communion tomorrow morning?
Yeah.
Right, when we talk about honor and glory. It's a great way to do those two things together. All right? So, John. No, come on. Yeah, we got there. Right, so we have three questions we're going to look at. First of all, what is truth? And then tonight, what is holiness and what is glory? So today, what is truth? It's just going to get through. This is kind of in a strange spot. You want to just drag that across? Is that possible? Thank you. I can't get by without my assistant. It's very helpful. So let's just say a few things about where the modern world is at. An elder in my church stood on my computer 2 weeks ago. Just right across on top of it. We were cramped for space. But it's a Mac, and it's still... So enough of that. What is truth? Well, let me say a few things, first of all, about the modern world. I've chosen these images because these are kind of the icons of the great meta-narrative of modernity. It's all about progress. It's all about hope. We can do this. But we need to say a little bit about where this whole story began. Increasingly, people are realizing that the truly transformative moment in Western history was not the Enlightenment and was not the Age of Reason. It happened back in the 11th and 12th century when Aristotle made his way back into Europe. Right? And we're going to have to say a few things about who Aristotle was and why that's so important. But this is the shift. So medieval studies are now becoming a real focus because that seems to be the moment when things began to change in the Western world. So let's say a few things about what happened then. First of all, what Aristotle did, and he's different from Plato, Aristotle says actually the natural world matters. You can learn some things about the truth by looking at the natural world. Right? And what that meant was in Western history, for the first time, you begin to get a division between two books, the Book of Nature and the Book of Revelation. This turns out to be quite a bun fight. That's a technical term, not. In the University of Paris between the Department of Theology and the Department of Humanities. Because there's a big struggle going on as to how do you get access to the truth. And Aristotle says you must pay attention to nature. Right? Now, up until that point, people weren't really doing it as clearly as they should be. A little footnote here. This is really where Christianity enables modern science to be born. It's an interesting thing, but the Greeks, with all their reliance on reason, never developed science. I gave a lecture on this at two universities in China just this last summer. What did Christianity bring to the table that enabled modern science to develop? Well, it wasn't Greek thought, because Greek thought was all about imposing rationality on what you saw. Right? So for the Greeks, you know, this idea of, you know, fire, wind, earth, water, all the bad stuff kind of sinks toward the earth, so that's kind of the earth and water. And when they see the earth at the center of the cosmos, that's not a compliment. Right? That's where the cruddy stuff goes. That's us, that's you, that's this world around us. We'll see why in just a bit. Right? The really wonderful stuff is the stuff that doesn't change, and that's what's out there amongst the stars. So when Socrates dies, you know, he says, "Don't weep for me, Argentina. Twinkle, twinkle, little Socrates, how I wonder what you are. I'm going to go join the stars and be part of this perfect world." Right? So because the Greeks are thinking through the lens of what they think perfection is about, they say, for example, the perfect shape is what? What's the perfect shape? Yep, the sphere, okay? So because they know the heavens are perfect, the stars must move in what kinds of orbits? Right, circular orbits. That holds back astronomy for centuries because they're not actually looking. They're imposing their categories on what they see. And who is it who really brings the breakthrough in this area? It'd probably surprise you. A certain Christian, and in terms of history of religious thought, probably one of the greatest innovators the church has ever seen. Galileo, close, but not quite, before him even. You probably won't guess this guy unless you know something about the history. Think of a Christian saint who seems at the other end of the universe from science. Brother, Son, Sister, Moon. Who's that?
Francis.
St. Francis of Assisi, right? The guy who runs around kind of talking to the birds. Right? And you think, how can that possibly happen? He's one of the first Christians to say, look at the world as it is and stop imposing your categories on it. That's where Christianity brings the critical moment to actually cause science to arise, because instead of imposing our expectations, we actually start looking without expectation. Right? And the critical move in all of that is that our God created freely without any having to obey any other requirements except his own will. The Greeks could never make that assumption because their gods are always subject to wisdom. So they impose wisdom and they never actually see the way the world operates. Right? So anyway, Aristotle says you've got to pay attention to the world. And in this Christian environment, as you start to look at nature, now creates a tension between the book of Revelation and the book of nature. And some of you have come up against this, right? Christian faith and science. Okay? Now, along comes Thomas Aquinas, the so-called dumb ox, who turns out to be this extraordinary genius and manages to pull together Aristotle and Christianity with bits of Plato. And he kind of shores up this Christian synthesis with his Summa Theologia. It's a Theologica, an amazing piece of work. Aquinas himself is an interesting guy. He had an experience toward the end of his life. He goes to Mass in St. Bernardo's in Napoli. And while he's celebrating Mass, he has an experience. He's a great champion of Christian theology in Europe. The Pope's gone in doing all kinds of things to get this synthesis working, celebrating Mass. He sits down and he says to the guy next to him, "I will write no more." And the guy next to him is just astonished and can't believe this. Right? So later on he says to him, "You can't do that. You're the kind of champion of Christianity. You're writing this great stuff. What do you mean?" And he says, "After what I've seen, everything I've written is straw." I wonder what he saw. Just one of those little interesting moments in history. And he really didn't write another thing, and he died, I think, 3 or 4, 6 months later. The great minds of European history. So he manages to paper over these cracks, but they're not going to stay papered over for long because, first of all, in the 13th century, you begin to get this, once more, the exaltation of nature over revelation. And it's partly because this Christian thing that Aquinas gets going soon becomes just this old conservative, very narrow way of thinking, and it's not very creative. People are kind of reacting against that, and in particular, Roger Bacon, who also happens to be a Franciscan. Right? And he says, no, you've got to pay attention to what you see, and this is called the Novum Organon. It's the new way of thinking, and it really is kind of one of the foundations of the modern Western world. So he gives rise to something called empiricism. Very much the British tradition. Right? Look at what's around you. Try and explain what's around you. Stop all of this theorizing because it doesn't help us. We've got people arguing about how many angels you can fit on the head of a pin. This is ridiculous. Right? In the 13th century, we have plague, we have famine. We've got to find some way out of this. Christianity is not helping us in its traditional formulations, so we have to find another way of looking at the world. And he says, you need to use reason and just look at the world around you. Now, he's still a Christian, but he's actually saying within the Christian context, this is what you do. Then sometime later, René Descartes. You've heard of Descartes? I think, therefore, I am. Right? So, first, Roger Bacon, what you see is what matters. And for Descartes, what you think is what matters. Right? These are the way into understanding the world. These are the ways. The problem is this. What about ethics? You see, Roger Bacon proposed his Novum Organum and his new way of thinking because he wanted to free people from the fear of plague and disease and to somehow give humanity control over wild nature. That was his ethic, right? But the problem is, if you're going to say the only way to find the truth is on the basis of what you can actually study, well, you can't get ethics from this. So his very approach to truth undermined his ethical motivation that he was coming from in the first place. And I want to suggest that this is the real problem, actually. We are, in fact, ethical beings, and we keep trying to tell ourselves we're pluralist and we can believe what we want to believe and we're all postmodernist. But, you know, you want to be in Canada, the great pluralist country, and then watch what happens when people start talking about George Bush and the Second Iraqi War. Now, I'm not going to go down that road, except to say it's amazing how many postmodernists become suddenly modernist absolutists over that ethical question, right? Where do they get that from? And I think what's happened is what both Bacon and Descartes failed to realize is that we are first and foremost moral, ethical beings. Human beings make judgments about what's right and what's wrong based on our perception of meaning and significance. Now, that's been the problem in Western philosophy ever since Bacon and Descartes. We simply can't come up with any foundation for our ethics on the basis of those two ways of operating. Because human beings do transcend the natural world. There's something about us that enables us to withdraw from our environment. We're not just reacting to it. We're able to step back a bit and analyze it and think about our response to it. That's a really interesting ability. And here's our problem. If we have reduced reality just to the natural world, what you can deal with science, right, then you've got a problem because you can't explain your transcendence. That's why our Western culture is in such a mess at the moment. We don't have the tools to talk about ethics because our way of talking about the truth has been reduced to what Bacon and Descartes said. Right? So we've cut off our legs and now we're trying to go in a marathon and we're wondering why we're not getting very far. That's the problem. So I want to suggest we have a long time ago made a mistake about the nature of reality and how it is we understand it. Right? You can't explain your transcendence on the basis of the things you transcend. Got that? Can't explain my transcendence on the basis of the things I transcend. There's something about me that's able to rise above just the natural world. That aboveness can't be explained by the stuff. It's actually over. Is that all right? And come and talk to me over lunchtime if you don't quite get that. But it's a critical point. So, what do we do then? Well, we live with the consequences of this failure. So, what begins to happen? Medieval Europe had done this amazing thing for all of its faults and failings, and there were many. It had done something that was astonishing. And that was, it had created a larger view of humanity that transcended mere tribalism. Did this in all kinds of ways. First of all, it gave an international language, Latin. So people in France, people in England, people in, you know, Northern Europe could all talk to one another in one language. That's critical if you're going to understand people. In fact, some folks have argued that the reason we've developed different kinds of languages was so that we could tell who the enemy was. The person who didn't speak my language, that's the person I can kill. There's a whole study about that. The history of warfare and conflict in the history of humanity is just devastating. Someone said if Europe had kept on killing people at the rate it had, some 2,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago, billions of people would have died. Now, I've got the references to that if you want it, but I don't want to spend too much time there. So one of the things that Europe brings, or the church brings, is Latin, a common speech, and that begins to facilitate a greater sense of humanity. When I can understand you, I realize you are, in fact, another human being. You know, it's one of the things that happens when they train you in the military. Right? Well, one of the things you have to do is dehumanize your opponent. You have to do that. You can't see the other person you're killing as a human being. Do that, and you're in serious, serious trouble. You have to be trained just to somehow override that instinct. There's a wonderful film called Joyeux Noël. Anyone seen it? French movie? It's brilliant, right? It's about the first Christmas in World War I. I mentioned a couple of guys here, where in the German trenches, was it? I think it might have been in the French, in the Scottish trenches, someone started to play a Christmas carol. The Germans joined in. And the next thing you know, they start singing with one another across the trenches. Then they come out and decide, completely without consulting the generals, look, it's Christmas Eve. We're not going to lose the war on the basis of Christmas Eve. Let's just get together. And so they did. The next day, they're playing soccer together between the trenches. Right? Now, when you've done that, it's very hard to start shooting at one another. So the next thing that happens is the German troops learn there's going to be a barrage, and they send somebody across to the English and say, come over our side, because we're going to bomb you in a minute. So they go across and share the trenches with them, and then the Brits do the same thing. Our guys are going to attack you, so come over and sit in our trenches. Well, when the generals hear about this, they are not pleased. No? Right? And one of the great tragedies in that film is that a bishop actually joins with the generals in removing the local priests, the chaplains who are with the troops who are facilitating this. I just hang on to that. That's amazing. And that's what Europe had, in one sense, with Latin and language. The monasteries managed to bring a sense of peace to Europe, and that's when Europe began to take off economically. All kinds of ways in which this Christian synthesis was doing tremendous things in Europe. Right? And you know what? The scholars in China know this. I was there a couple of summers ago, Chinese Academy of Social Science. They actually believe that the real turning point was what happened in Europe at this point in time. And they understand that the engine of the modern world is Christianity. That's what these Marxist scholars told me at the pinnacle of social sciences in China. Christianity is the engine of modernization. That's why we've got you to come and teach our people what the New Testament means. I can't imagine that happening in many universities here in North America, certainly not in Canada. But, you know, we're pluralists and we're not kind of caught up in ideology, are we? Well, what happens is individual conscience now becomes most important. Right, and there's some role for that, but if it becomes the most important thing, guess what happens? Now you end up with a 30 years war. I don't know if you know much about this, but for some people, the most devastating war Europe has ever seen, and it's fought between Christians over issues of theology. Right. And we got messed up in politics too. For me, this is when the Christian vision really gets torpedoed. Right. Because we can talk about theology all we like, but people remember this. No, it's your actions, folks. It's not your ability to describe God, it's how you live him out. That's what counts. And if you talk to people who aren't Christians today and begin to listen to why they're not Christians, see how much of it has to do with theory and see how much of it has to do with the Christians they bumped up against. That's why tonight's talk is so important. What is the nature of holiness? Get that one wrong and we're in trouble. You have the wrong view of holiness and the wrong view of theology. You will go to war, causing all kinds of devastation in the name of some theological idea. Even carrying on your flags the image of the cross. And you wonder how people can do that. Well, I think the answer is, talk about theology in the wrong way and ideas are going to be more important than people, and then you're in serious trouble. Right? So you end up with this. Here it is. I mean, these guys celebrating up this devastating battle and thanking God that they've managed to slaughter thousands of Catholics. Like, I can just see Jesus rejoicing. All right? So, what happens now is thinkers look at what dogma and revelation led to and they say, we should now rely on individual reason. All right? We have to bear a large part of the blame for the shift in our world. Because when we got involved in dogma and we talked about revelation, the outcome was often intolerance and bloody conflict. And you see echoes of it today with as many denominations as you can hardly count, all saying they follow Jesus. Have we missed something here? I think we have. Let's hope your generation can do something better. Now, the consequence of that is the splintering of medieval Europe leads eventually to Flanders Fields. This is kind of a Canadian moment. It's a very famous Canadian poem, but it's about the devastation. What we discover is reason cannot establish ethics. That's what Nietzsche talks about. Schopenhauer, they recognize this doesn't work. So all that matters is for Schopenhauer, the will to life. For Nietzsche, that becomes the will to power. And guess what that looks like? When German soldiers go to war in World War I, they take two books, the Bible and Nietzsche. And where does that lead you? From a 30-year Christian war that's devastating to total war that's even worse. Right? And this leads us to the postmodern dilemma, if you can't read that very clearly. So, you know, all this certainty of knowledge we thought we had, it's all up in the air, folks. The library is blowing all over the place. That, by the way, is the point of the book by Umberto Eco called The Name of the Rose. Anybody read that? Right. Well, what I've just told you about is what Umberto Eco's novel is all about. The collapse of the Christian synthesis. Right. And at the end of the book, Adso is left with a few fragments and can't make sense of it. Welcome to the postmodern world. Right. Reason has failed us. So what do we do? Well, Stanley Fish has talked about this, and he's a very famous postmodern person. Heard of him, Stanley Fish, some of you? Yep. Well, you all know that postmodernists are people who believe that, you know, everything's relative, there's no absolutes, right? Wrong. That's kind of the street-level version of postmodernism. That's not what the serious postmodernist thinkers understand. Because Stanley Fish will say, I believe that at all times and in all places, it is always wrong to torture children merely for entertainment. I'm committed to that. He says, I say, without any mental reservation at all, I believe that to be absolutely true. We are not saying there are no absolutes. What we're saying is there's no mathematics and there's no algebra whereby you can prove that to another rational human being. That's what he means by postmodernism. This project begun by Francis Bacon and René Descartes in the end will not help you establish ethics. You can't do it. And if you go down that road as your primary motivation, you end up with a Western Europe that's presently dying because it does not know how to act anymore. It's been so committed to this particular way of knowing the world, Bacon, Descartes, it's crippled now when it tries to talk about ethics because it's blinded itself to any of that kind of reality simply by defining truth in those terms. Now, that's essential. It's essential to recognize that. Part of the problem is you get people writing books called theological science. Right? Because we think science is the way to go, we start doing theology like that. That's a disastrous move because what's the problem with science? It can't give us ethics. And the outcome of that is you go to seminaries and you'll take 3 semesters of systematic theology, and then if you want to do ethics, you have to take an elective called theological ethics, as though somehow ethics is peripheral and an elective when it comes to talking about God. Now, if that's not bizarre, I don't know what is. But you see, if what matters then is the coherence of the system, you will happily go to war for 30 years and destroy other people. Because it's primarily about this knowledge, this thing called the truth that exists out there, and somehow that's more important than people, and you end up with this really strange situation. I think something has gone seriously wrong in the way we've been thinking about God. I need to unpack some of that. So, searching for the truth. Right? Is that okay so far? We kind of got ourselves through the modern world. I know I've been skipping through that really quickly. My wife, if she was here, she'd be kind of jumping up and down at this point. But I know, as a friend of mine said, you know, we had a guy come and lecture at Regent once, and it was really kind of high-powered lecture. And the respondent said, well, I guess a lot of you wouldn't have got all of this, but it's okay. There's cookies on every shelf. There's a lot of cookies on the top, and there are some down below. So take what you can. Right? But I do think this is important, and if it just gets you thinking and then we can have some conversations about it later, then that's great. All right? So the big question is, what's the nature of truth and how do we find it? And, of course, it's not just the modern world that's thought about this. And I'm sorry, if I had a little... I should have asked for a microphone here. In fact, I'll just put this down, but here's the answer, okay?
Immortality! Take it! It's yours!
No son of Troy will ever submit to a foreign ruler.
Then every son of Troy shall die.
Now you know who you're fighting.
Is there no one else? Is there no one else?
Brad Pitt is getting older too, so I feel better every day. This is why you need to know your history, because that's what you are a product of. You are a product of your history. And our way of knowing by talking about science has effectively been to deny our history. And if you don't know your history, you're going to be its victim. So let's talk about some of our Western history. And very briefly, in the 14th century BC, the Mycenaean Empire collapsed and there are about 500 years of Dark Ages. And in the 8th century, emerging out of that came Homer and a chap called Hesiod. And these guys began to give the Greeks some idea of what it meant to be human beings, which for them meant to be Greek. Right? You've got to hear that. Barbarians, not really human beings. Not sure about women either. But Greek men, they were human. Right? So, emphasis on the godlike, heroic warrior. But at the same time, if you read the Iliad, you know, the story of the Battle of Troy, you realize there are deep misgivings about the nature of warfare and its brutality. So even though Achilles stars as this great figure, when King Priam of Troy comes to regain the body of Hector, it's powerful as you realize the deep ambiguity about the role of warfare and conflict in the development of civilization. Now, for the Greeks, many of them just took it for granted that the way a civilization grew was through war. That's just what people did. It's just the natural state of a growing civilization. And then you think about how different it is today, and the reason is the story of Jesus, actually. That's what changed that outlook. But we're not there yet. Now, some challenges began to emerge. First of all, the rise of democracy with Cleisthenes in Athens. This developed the notion of argument. When you've got people discussing what the shape of your society should be, now it's a matter of argument. Homer simply said this is how the world was. Now you have to argue your case. The rise of democracy does that. In addition, various poets like Xenophanes and others begin to look at the way Homer's gods behave and say, this is really bad. Notice the critique, ethical. Notice how important that is? You understand why the Bible is so concerned about character? Absolutely central, the character of the Christian life. First major critique of Homer's narratives come with the poet's critique of the ethics of the character of their gods. It's no wonder the Greeks have to resort to philosophy, because who's going to trust their gods? Right? Do they have to now think their own way through this? Finally, the sophists turn up. The sophists have been traveling all over the ancient world. They've seen all kinds of different cultures. They come to Athens, and the Athenians are a bit like Canadians. Sorry, right? But the Canadians are all that kind of just, you know, we know we're the best people in the world. And we just see people south of the border, you just don't get it. But we really know that we are. And it kind of peeves us that you're more successful than we are. So we have to keep saying, you know, we're not Canadians, right? It's not called a sofa, it's called a Chippendale. And it's not, we have ads like this. There are some issues north of the border, right? Anyway, so, you know, here we are, we're happy Canadians, and we think, yep, we know what it means to be that. I mean, just we just live with that. And then somebody turns up from Bosnia, or someone turns up from Iran and says, well, how do you know? Because we do things differently. And we have no answer. And that's exactly what happened in Athens. These guys turned up and said, okay, so you Athenians are doing all this stuff, but how do you know that what you're doing is actually the way the world is, which is where the word physics comes from? Is it actually the way the world is, or is it merely convention? Now, that's where the whole sexuality debate emerges. What is the nature of our sexuality? Is it really the way we are, or is it merely convention? So when we say marriage should just be between a man and a woman, is that really the way the world is? Is that physics, or is it merely a matter of convention? And we get caught out in that one because we don't really understand the difference and we don't know how to argue for it. And we've already been kind of convinced that physics is the only way to talk about the truth, so now we're seriously in trouble when we try to talk about something that in many ways is just convention. Well, what happens if that's true? The sophists say, well, everything now just is a matter of how good an arguer you are. And that's what begins to happen in Greece. And I think it's what's happening in North America today. Right? It's more about how persuasive you can be. It's more about the power of your rhetoric than whether or not what you're saying is actually true or right or good. Right? That's what it just collapses into. Because our way of seeing the world doesn't give us any basis on which we can have any kind of certainty about ethics. Now it's all to do with who can come up with the best kind of argument, but argument in terms of moral high ground. And the answer is, if you want to win an argument in the Western world, put yourself in the place of the victim. That's what you have to do. You have to turn yourself into the victim. If you're the victim, then everything now becomes about the oppressor and the oppressed, and we all know that you mustn't oppress the one who's being oppressed. And that's what the sexuality debate has become, even in the churches. Becomes a justice issue, right? And somehow God is going to be judged by what we think justice is. There's a major problem when that happens, right? Well, people can't live with this. They can't live with a world where human beings just decide for themselves what's going to be good, beautiful, and true, because it just disintegrates into these power plays. Right? So the Greeks know that, and they try to deal with it. So, a guy called Parmenides reminds you of the cheese you put in your pizza, Parmenides cheese, right? He's thinking about this, and he says, you know what? If it's true, it can't change. If something's true, it's going to be true today, true yesterday, true tomorrow, right? Good truth, good position, I think. Heraclitus comes along a bit later and says, hang on, have you looked in the mirror lately? Huh? Have you? Everything changes. Can't step into the same river twice. Now, that's a problem, isn't it? If everything around us changes, where are you going to get the truth from? Right? What does that mean about the natural world, given that it's constantly changing? How much truth do you think you can find in a changing world? Well, it's okay, because along comes Plato. Right? This is a Polaroid from the ancient world. Socrates develops the technique of probing question. We call this dialectic, question and answer. So he comes across some guy, you know, in the city, and, so my good man, tell me about justice, right? Well, justice means this, this, and this. And then Socrates asks a little question, well, but what about that? Well, that's very interesting, my good man, but what about this? Well, you've just contradicted yourself, haven't you? This is not the way to win friends. Walking around the place showing everybody that they're basically fools. Not a good thing, and they don't like him for doing this. In fact, some people have suggested that Socrates is the supreme ironist. His point is, we actually don't understand. We think we do, but we don't. I agree with him. I like Socrates because he reminds us of how fragile we are. We sang that this morning in the hymn. We blossom and flourish like leaves on a tree. And then we change the line, but the old line is, and wither and perish, but naught changes thee. Now, we know that physically. I want to argue that intellectually. I want to argue that human beings are not as strong intellectually as we thought we were. That we are fragile and frail in every part of our being. We cannot sustain our own existence physically, and we cannot sustain our intellectual life on our own. It has to come from somewhere else, and Socrates at least understands that. Right. Okay, how do we get the unchanging truth that Parmenides wanted in a changing world? And his answer was, the truth lies in the enlightened eternal soul. He really invents the idea of the immortal soul at this point. But at least he recognizes that you've got to get stuff from outside if you're going to make sense of this. And that's why a lot of the early church fathers gravitate towards to Plato. Right? Now, gone time-wise, got 15 minutes, okay, or less. In response to Plato, Aristotle says, but hang on a minute, I think I can learn some things about the natural world. And this is where the division comes in and people aren't really, they don't quite pick up on this shift that happens. Right? Aristotle says you can learn some things, and in fact, he develops what we might call the analytical logic machine, the syllogism. He's the first one to really articulate this. If A equals B, B equals C, then A equals C. Right, now, don't worry about that. If you don't get it, it's early in the morning, I know. But it's kind of the basis of reasoning from observation. And it's extremely powerful because what it does now is it gives us truth independent of culture. If the sophist introduced multiculturalism and now it's all up for grabs, Aristotle says, well, actually, no, we can learn some truths, like things to do with the weight of a gallon of water. But they're all truths about the unchanging natural world, and they're very, very powerful in terms of giving us science, but the slippage is they're not going to help us when it comes to ethics, even though Aristotle thinks he can get ethics by doing this. The problem is when he starts talking about ethics, he simply assumes his Greek culture. So he talks about the four cardinal virtues, right? Anyone know what they are? Wisdom, prudence, courage. What else? Okay, well, I should point out there's no mention of compassion in this list, which is why Greek culture looks like it does. Right? So justice, wisdom, prudence, and what's the other? Practical wisdom, I think. Yeah. So what this leads to, this is the project they begin about the 3rd century BC, 4th, 3rd century BC. Now we've got a way forward. We can answer the sophists. We have a way of getting to the truth. What actually happens? Not in theory. And at university, we do this all the time. I come with these wonderful systems of concepts, but what actually happened? Right. Well, this is what happened. By the 2nd and 3rd century, this whole philosophical project had collapsed. As people pursued this, they began to realize it didn't really work. So the Epicureans, if the gods exist, they don't care about us. The Stoics, they think, well, this is kind of, you know, reason behind everything. But if there is this kind of overarching reason, then what happens to human freedom? If everything's determined by this kind of overarching logos that's working, what does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean about freedom? And these people end up becoming terribly depressed. Because how do I actually assert myself as a human being? How do I find some way of acting in the world? And the modern version of that is if everything's controlled by by equations and chemical processes in our bodies, what does that mean about human freedom? How can you ever say to somebody you shouldn't have done that if it's simply, if everything gets reduced to science? Well, it's not my fault. I'm just made this way. Why should I have to take responsibility for my actions? So if this is the thing that, you know, math or science or whatever, if this kind of mechanical thing controls everything, what does that do to being human? Well, by the 2nd and 3rd century, violent, rampant materialism, social decay, falling population, does any of that sound familiar? Does it? You want to know why? We've gone down exactly the same road. We rediscovered the Greek philosophers back in the 11th and 12th century, and we thought, let's go and pursue knowledge like they did because it sounds great, and we love to be autonomous. We love to think that through our own reason we can make sense of this, and we're following exactly the same track. Right? This is what is happening in a Western world devoted to the idea that through our own thinking we can establish truth. We can find meaning. We can't, and we're collapsing. Despair, the rise of magic and mystical escapism. That sound a bit familiar? Yes, right? So Clement of Alexandria, Christian guy, one of his favourite challenges to the pagans was this. After 600 years of the best of philosophical argument and scientific observation, where has it taken us? Only to chaos and despair. So stick that in your pipe and smoke it, you Greek philosopher. It's just really, right? He goes at him, right? And we need to find a way to do that graciously, but front people on that issue. We have been trying your reliance on human reason for the last 600 years, and look where we are now. Look at what's happening to our families. Look at what's happened in the marketplace. Right? Folks, this doesn't work. And it's time for Christians to stand up and be able to say some things like this and be kind of bold about it, but in a gracious way. And it's amazing what the responses are. People kind of go, well, yeah, right? But when that happens, people are feeling vulnerable. No one likes to kind of have the rug pulled out from underneath them. So it's really important that you watch the way you do this. I can be a bit provocative here because we're kind of in-house. I'm not going to be quite so provocative when I'm talking to people who are committed to this view. That's failing. So what did change the ancient world? Well, it wasn't the selfish gene. This is the problem with people who do science in some kind of ivory tower hypothesizing. I mean, it's a very interesting idea, but I'm more concerned with what actually happened, as should scientists, I believe. Right? Aren't scientists really concerned about what actually happens, not what you theorize? Isn't that why you do experiments? Yes? Right? So what actually changed the Roman world? Did a selfish gene appear suddenly somewhere out of the blue and do all of this? Is that what happened? Right? Was it Greek philosophy? Absolutely not. It failed. In fact, Galen in the second century, who's the father of modern anatomy, or father of anatomy period, he thought Christianity was rubbish, as most of the intellectuals did back then, because it didn't rely on human reason to get going. And for that, for them, that was just right automatically out of bounds. But he's the first pagan philosopher to treat Christianity seriously. And you know why? Because of what this story did to people. For him, philosophy was about enabling people to act virtuously and to remove the fear of death. But philosophy was an elite exercise, only for a few tiny percentage of people at the very top of the hierarchy. What astonished Galen was that he saw Christianity changing people without any real sophisticated education. And that's what spoke to most pagan apologists in the ancient world, was the ethical character of Christian lives. You see what the point? You see what's going on there? It's the importance of ethics, the very thing that science can't address. Can I suggest to you that the most powerful apologetic you have is the quality of your character? And that's why so many of you like being a part of this church. You might never have quite put it that way, but you love the way it treats people, right? Isn't that true? You come into this community and it's not about ego, it's not about competitiveness, it's not about elbowing somebody else out of the road to get to the top. You might not have thought about it, but it's actually a nice place to be because people care about you, right? Isn't that true? Come on, isn't it true? Sure it is. Do you realize how precious that is? Many of you work outside in a different environment and you see very different things going on out there. Right? That matters to people. But as long as we put truth in terms of it's got to be scientific, we won't realize what a powerful thing we have to say to people. Right? That's one thing to experience it, but given our environment, you've got to learn to be able to say this in a more academic way, because that's what people are going to listen to first off. So you've got to walk them through the history and help them see. Then when they come and experience what's going on, they're going to be able to put the two things together, their thinking and their feeling. You're going to make meaning of their lives by bringing together these two things. You embody it, but you're able to talk to them. You start where they are, because most of them just start intellectually. Start there and give them the freedom to talk about what's going on emotionally. Right? And you do that by dethroning science as a fundamental paradigm. You do it by dethroning philosophy as a fundamental paradigm. Now, a bit of that in a moment, in my remaining 3 minutes. It wasn't technology or politics. So what was it that changed the ancient world? And the answer is, without any shadow of a doubt, this. The astonishing story of Jesus. I think I spoke about this last time I was here. Rodney Stark's written a book called The Rise of Christianity. He wrote it as a non-Christian. You need to read this book if you haven't. It wasn't a selfish gene. Perhaps the most radical words ever spoken in the ancient world were the words of Paul when he said, "In Christ there is no longer male nor female, slave nor free, Jew nor Gentile." In an ancient world that was all about hierarchy, here comes somebody who says, those hierarchies no longer apply. What brought him to that position? Not a selfish gene, but an encounter with the resurrected Jesus. That's what changed the Roman world. We need to be able to tell that story. Dawkins can say what he does because, pardon me, he's such a poor historian. But he's like most of us who think history's bunk and it's all about building more Fords. Well, we're living with a world where we built our life on building Fords. And is it a happy world? I don't think so. So, this is why when Origen responds to Celsus, as I said last night, Christianity is not a philosophy. Don't turn Christianity into a philosophy, because the moment you do that, you begin to make human reason the primary category, and the moment you go down that road, you have lost the farm already. It's not even an idea, because we did not dream up this story about the God who comes to us in Jesus. As we'll see tonight when we talk about holiness and tomorrow when we talk about glory. This is so fundamentally different from everything we know. And Origen understands that. Christianity is an event. Something happened among us and it's just turned our world upside down. And now, that having happened, we can think about it. But we don't start with our thinking. We start with the event of the coming of Jesus. This is why Christmas is far more important to me than New Year's Eve celebrations. New Year's Eve celebrations, what is it? It's not a new year. It's just the same year under a new name, just over and over again, right? same thing, right? So I have to confess, I don't even stay up for New Year's Eve. I just go to bed. Right? But the days I celebrate, the one night I do stay up for, is every Christmas Eve I go to the midnight service, because that is the beginning of a whole new world. Right? And that I will celebrate. Because the God who came among us in Jesus was so radically different, it changed the world so that you women are sitting here and we're going to treat you like equals. Whereas if we were in the ancient world right now, we go out and have a bit of a meal, and after that it was a sexual free-for-all and you were simply an object for my lust. That's all you would be, most of you. What changed that? So the women can sit here, be part of worship, think about God and be treated with dignity and respect. It was not Greek philosophy. It was the story of Jesus, a God who is unlike any other. Right? Don't turn this into a series of disembodied ideas, mathematical equations about God. Don't do that. It's far too powerful. Right? I'm preaching a bit, but I can't help it. So, well, it's 10:30 and I should probably stop here. Going for a little bit? Maybe take 15 minutes, is that all right? Okay, is your tail, your butts holding up, are they? Okay, I'll be disciplined and try and get through this. So, what is truth? We're regaining the priority of history. That's the wonderful move, right? Origen understood that. Christianity is about history. Now, the great thing about this is non-Christian people have already done a lot of the homework for us in our modern world, which is brilliant, because you don't just have to sound like rabid Christian apologists. We can point to their very own people, their very own intellectuals. So, Wilhelm Dilthey, don't worry about the name too much, but he recognised you can't do history like science. People are besotted with science, and you can understand why. Begins to free people from the plague, begins to free people from famine. You know, I hear young people these days, oh, you know, modernity, da-da-da-da, right? The modern world's awful, right? And they write their criticisms down on their laptop computer, right? And they're healthy while they do so, and they're living in a world where they're kind of free from political oppression. All of those things come from modernity. So a little plea from the heart, don't be a goose. There are a lot of good things about modernity. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Be thoughtful about modernity, but don't just throw the whole thing away, right? There are some good things. Your teeth are a testimony to modernity. Go to England and it looks very different. No? So, you can't do history like science. They recognize that. Why not? Well, here's my friend Benedetto Croce. I love the Italians, actually. I mean, I have German blood in me, so I'm not having a shot at the Germans. But we Germans are kind of like this, aren't we? Right? That is how it must be. Except the German romantics, but even they kind of have that to it. The Italians, I love going to Italy. It's all kind of a bit tatty around the edges. They love life, great food. And for some reason, they just seem to have people who can think outside the box. Croce's one of them. He's a Marxist, grew up in a Catholic family. His village was destroyed by an earthquake. He lost most of his family, suffering, and lost his faith. That's the big one, folks. You've got to learn to think through a Christian response to suffering. And that's not a scientific question. That's a question about meaning and character. Right? Got to deal with that one. And he says, I'm sorry about this. Croce said, you know what? Science is about universals. It's about the stuff that doesn't change. Right? And I'm glad about that. I fly across the Pacific many times. I would not be very happy if the laws of nature changed in Beijing. Right? I would be in serious trouble. Okay? That's what makes science so powerful. It's the stuff that doesn't change, and that's what Aristotle said I'm looking for. If I can find that, we can control it, and we discover the so-called laws of nature, and that's brilliant, right? Science is about universals, but history is not about universals. Marx tried that, it didn't work. What makes history interesting are the particulars. We are different people. We live in different cultures. Right? Every moment that humans are engaged in making decisions are different. No, they're not the same kind of thing. And Croce's thinking about that. He says, that's why you can't do history like science. History's a different kind of thing. And then he starts to think a bit more about it. So he says, well, what actually is science? And this is meant to be Galileo. He's kind of a sainted picture there because he was painted by someone who obviously belonged to the Church of Galileo. And behind her, of course, is a wonderful mural from Siena. Anyone been to Siena? One of my favourite Italian towns. It's a beautiful place. So this is to do with culture, and this is to do with science, or this is history, and this is science. And Croce says, what is the nature of science? And he says, okay, let's think about it. Got this guy Galileo, right? What nationality is Galileo? Australian? No, right? He's Italian. And when does he live? First century BC? No, what? 17th century? 16th century? Somewhere around there. I'm not really sure of the dates. Some of you might know, right? That means he's shaped by his culture. He's shaped by his education. His questions are shaped by the world in which he lives. His ability to make a telescope is determined by the technology they have. Right? What are we doing right now? We're doing history. Right? We're talking about history, and what happens is at a particular point, maybe 9:30 Monday morning, 15th of May, 1578, I have no idea, right? Creates this telescope, gets this idea, and then that night looks at the sky. That's history. And he keeps doing that, and out of the history, he comes up with a theory. Right. Now, Croce says, let's be really careful about this, because that theory is not real like Galileo is real. It's an intellectual construct. And scientists get very excited about that because they can write it as an equation. What they forget is that equation is always subject to change based on what? A different experience. Right? That's why we talk about the experimental basis of science. It's all meant to be about looking at the natural world. And Croce's observation then, well, is if that's true. Oops, went to press two buttons there. Look, go back. Yeah. If that's true, then science is actually dependent on history, because your history determines what you're looking for and what you see. But so too is philosophy, because Plato was a Greek. Nietzsche was a German, and they're all shaped by their history. They're asking questions that come out of their history. That's why you can talk about the history of philosophy. Why? Because philosophy is not constant. It keeps changing. On the basis of what? People's experience. At the bottom of everything lies history. And Origen says, yes! So I'm trying to tell you from the very beginning. Everything is based on your experience. So when a scientist wants to say to me, I don't believe in the resurrection because it's against natural law, I say, I'm sorry, you are making a fundamental category error. We talk about the resurrection in terms of historical arguments, and if there's good evidence for that, then science, you just have to deal with it. Right? You don't let science tell you what history can do, nor can you let philosophy tell you what history can do. Nor can you let theology tell you what history can do. That's what the Pharisees did. We have our theology. We know what the Messiah looks like. Jesus doesn't fit that category. Right? All you've got is history. Because that's where you're located. So what? Well, that's John's point. Something utterly amazing has happened. He doesn't say, we sat down and thought about this down at the Starbucks in Jerusalem for a couple of months and we've come up with this great idea. He says, no, we were there and stuff happened. We touched, we saw, we handled. That's all you have. We saw this guy tell the sea what to do. And I don't care what you scientists might theorize about it. We were there, we saw it. Now, you can understand all kinds of questions here, right? But history is messy. Some of you have been doing history, and you know right now the philosophy of history is in a mess. No one really knows what it means to do history. I think we're in the period when we're slowly breaking free of science being this primary determinative, and history's trying to come to grips with that. It's a very exciting moment, and it's a moment for Christians because these people are asking our questions, right? Why is it messy? Because it doesn't follow laws. That means we don't get to control it. Ah! No. The reason I marry you is to control you, isn't it, after all? No. So what do you have when you're dealing with history, right? Well, we have a way of dealing with this. We've had to do it for thousands of years. It happens in the law courts. In the law courts, it's about personal testimony, right? Now, the centrality of testimony came under serious question in the medieval period because the church got involved in telling lies. We created a document called the Donation of Constantine. It was a forgery, and we created it so we could argue that Constantine gave us the empire. We told a lie. You can't do that as a Christian and expect your testimony to carry weight. You simply cannot do that. And you only have to tell one and no one will trust you ever again. Listen to Paul. Speak the truth in love. Listen to Jesus. Don't swear by heaven and earth. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Because if you don't live a life of personal integrity, no one will listen to you when you're having to appeal to some kind of event that you're relating. They won't listen to you because they know they can't trust you. Different kinds of evidence and argument now about history. Let me give you a quick example. We're going to celebrate the Lord's Supper tomorrow. Right? We're going to have some bread and some wine, okay? And we're going to remember Jesus' death. Where does that come from? Anyone know the origins of this? Obviously Jesus, but going back, he's a Jew before that. Passover. The Passover, right? Now, what do you know about Passover? Very important meal for Israel. Goes right back to the Exodus story. Right? They celebrate this every year. It's their identity. Now, here's my question. What are the chances of a first century Jewish person taking that meal and saying, you know, you thought that was about Moses? Well, now it's about me. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to change the menu. Just historically, put yourself in the sandals of a first century Jewish person and just try and imagine anybody in that first century doing something like that. Or even imagining somebody doing something like that. Can you? Then how else do you explain the story? The only way I can explain the story of the Lord's Supper is that Jesus must have done something like this because it just doesn't make sense any other way. I cannot explain how this story is going to emerge just by some kind of natural development. It's just coming too far out of left field. Now, that's my area of study. I study Jesus. I want to tell you over and over and over again, there are things just flying in out of left field all the time. Right? These are historical arguments. It's why I am deeply committed to this story. I cannot explain it any other way. And remember, I'm already deeply committed to history. So don't bring scientific arguments, because if you do that, you don't understand what we're talking about. Go back to school and understand the nature of reality. Then come back and we'll talk about it. It's a problem with people like Dominic Crossan, for example. Doesn't really understand the difference between history and science. Different kind of evidence and argument. How do you explain the story of the resurrection? What Jewish person is expecting a single resurrection when nothing else has changed? That is so bizarre. Something must have happened, and that's John's argument. The reason we talk about what we do is because we experience something. It happened, right? So this is all about human agency. It's about what we do. You understand all history then is interpretation, because it's about human thought and intention. Whenever you make a decision, it's about your interpreting your action. That's what makes history different from science. What did we say last night? What's evangelism about? Evangelism is what? Making meaning. That's the center of what it means to be a human being. That's what history is about. And just like being human is messy, so is history messy. That's why people would love it to be like science, because science is nice and manageable, but history is not. Got to live with some stuff around the edges. We're almost there. Right. Everything. Messiness, ambiguity, and ultimately interpretation. You can see Jesus do stuff. The Pharisees do, and they think he's doing it by the power of Satan. Jesus says, no, I'm not. I'm doing it through the Holy Spirit. How are you going to assess that judgment? And you hear people say that. The blind man in John. Well, I'm not a theologian like you guys, but let me ask you, does God listen to sinners? And they drive him out. What do you mean, trying to tell us what to do? We've got PhD. Right? Well, this is the only thing I know. Once I was blind and now I see. That's history. Something's happened. And I know God doesn't answer the prayers of sinners. So, sorry, Descartes. We do not have absolute propositional truth, and John understands that. All we have is an interpretation of a past event. Now, I'm going to have to stop there because time's getting away. I might say a bit about this tonight, but we'll just let that go. What I try to argue for today, then, is that the nature of truth is fundamentally historical. And history has to do with testimony. And questions about how do you explain this event on an historical basis. And I try to suggest that the stories of Jesus can really only be explained because something like this must have happened. Right? Now, if that's true, what really makes this stuff sing? We're going to talk about it tonight when we get to the question of holiness. But let me just say something. What makes the Jesus story so persuasive for John is that it's actually about life. It's actually about life, because the thing that convinces the followers of Jesus that he's not just to be discarded on the trash heap of history is what? He came through death. Now, if you think life is all about being good, you won't hear how powerful that is. But if you understand that the critical question is a question of life and death, you're going to be very impressed when somebody comes through death and comes out the other side and says to you, if you trust me, I'll take you through death too and give you life. Well, you've been very patient. We've gone on for a bit. I know we've gone at a great rate of knots. I do apologise. I'll be around for lunch if you want to ask some questions, but I better get off here and let John take over before I get started again. So bless you. Thank you.